terrorism wasn't yet part of the vernacular on the morning of March 9th, 1977.
Think about this, how many experts the FBI had at that time in hostage negotiation and terrorism, one or two.
But Paul Green learned very quickly what it was 40 years ago today as he worked at the B'nai B'rith headquarters.
We just all better be prepared to die. We were told that throughout the entire thing.
The motive to take over three buildings in the district and hold hundreds of hostages had its origins 5 years earlier, when seven members of Hamas Abdul Khalees's family were murdered. A baby was drowned in a bathtub. It was revenge for a messy break Khalees had from the Nation of Islam.
They convicted him and all of them went to jail for life. But he couldn't swallow it. He just couldn't get it off his mind.
Former D.C. Police Chief Maurice Cullinane, speaking with the Our Town podcast, first got reports of the gunman at B'nai B'rith that morning.
I went up and was trying to talk to him and find out what was their complaint. And we were just yelling up and down the steps.
Khalees wanted those convicted of murdering his family to be turned over to him.
And he was going to give them the sentence that he thought they deserved. He was going to kill them.
He also wanted the movie Muhammad, Messenger of God, to be taken out of theaters because he saw it as sacrilegious.
Coming up the stairs was a man with two pistols. He saw me and I saw him. He screamed obscenities at me and with a big smile on his face told all of us standing there that we should hit the ground or we're dead.
At first, Green says he thought it was a robbery. That thought went out the window pretty quickly.
When I got to the door, well, the terrorist in the door swung his gun at me, hit me in the face, full flush in the face with the barrel of the rifle, broke my cheekbone in six places, and cursed at me and told me to get down the stairs. He'd kill me.
While profusely bleeding, he was ordered up six flights of stairs and wasn't sure he'd make it.
Until Khalees indicated that if you fell down in the stairwell, they'd just kill you. So it's amazing how the adrenaline takes over.
And at the landing, on a day of many horrific sights, there was the one that still sticks out in his mind the most, a pile of about 50 of his co-workers.
Many people bleeding, many people hysterical. The threats of violent death were immediate.
He could hear the initial negotiations between Khalees and Cullinane, and when Khalees mentioned the murder, Green made the stunning connection.
I knew who this was, and I wasn't sure what he was doing in the neighbor's building. And what I had to do with it or my colleagues had to do with it, which was obviously absolutely nothing.
At the same time, gunmen were invading the Islamic Center on Massachusetts Avenue and what was then the district building, now known as the Wilson Building. Ward 4 Councilman Arrington Dixon had just finished up a Judiciary Committee meeting.
We leaving the meeting, heading back to my office, and we heard a bunch of rapid-firing weapons going off.
Dixon, his chief of staff and secretary, pushed a desk up against his office door.
That's where we stayed for quite a while.
He only found out by watching the news on his office television that one of his colleagues, the second-year councilman from Ward 8, had been shot. Marion Barry, the man who was to become the mayor for life, came within inches of death that day, Cullinane says.
Bullet hit him in a place that would have killed him, but the bullet had bounced off of the walls and it was spent.
The news showed Marion being rolled out. Seemed to be at least, you know, conscious and in good condition, but could have been much worse.
A young radio reporter for WHUR, Maurice Williams, was killed when his elevator door opened straight into the chaotic shooting scene. Dixon stayed in his office, even doing interviews.
You know, as a politician, you don't turn down interviews.
But he got a call from Cullinane.
He said, Arrington, everything you say is on the air, and they're listening along with us. Maybe you better stop talking. And I got the point and stopped.
Things were a little more comfortable for Dixon than they were for Green a few blocks up.
He started to arrange to string men up upside down in the window to give the sniper something to shoot at.
Unbeknownst to either of them, the lack of experience in terrorism situations from D.C. police and the FBI led them to looking to some outside sources for help. Iran's ambassador to the U.S., Ardeshir Zahidi, was the one who, after 39 hours, finally persuaded Khalees to give up. Zahidi did it by telling the story of his grandmother forgiving the killers of his grandfather. Khalees died in prison in 2003.
It wasn't until after the Hanafi siege that the United States government finally started working on counterterrorism issues.
Of course, today's terrorism is much different, Green says.
In today's world, as we know, the terrorists don't go in for negotiations or taking hostages. They're going to kill people.
He's since written a book about his and many others' experiences that day, Forgotten Hostages.
I needed to find out what was happening on the outside, and as well as I reconnected with a number of colleagues I hadn't seen in 30-some-odd years to capture their reflection.
It seems easy for Green to talk about what happened 40 years ago. He's done countless interviews about it in the years since. He says his injuries were more physical than psychological, but the enduring impact came to him soon after in an interview with his hometown paper in Miami.
And at the end of the interview, he asked me, he says, what's different? I said, I've always enjoyed the sky. It's always been blue. But now when I wake up in the morning and look outside, it's bluer than ever. And that blue sky is still incredibly blue after 40 years.
Steve Burns on WMAL and WMAL.com.